It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This week, the state legislature's Joint Finance Committee approved funding for a bill that would help finance the Veterans Housing and Recovery Program. That program would help veterans who are struggling with homelessness and mental health issues.
Last September, two of Wisconsin's three housing facilities for homeless veterans were closed. The shelters were located in Chippewa Falls and Green Bay.
Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle blamed each other for the funding gap that led to the closures. The Veterans Housing and Recovery Program funding was not included in the compromise budget reached by Governor Evers and Republican leadership in July.
To hear about what this funding allocation would do and the grant program to support it, we have Joey Hoey, Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. Joey, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Is it a challenge for veterans here in Wisconsin to secure safe and adequate housing around the state?
Yes, I think there's various estimates of the number, but yeah, it's pretty clear that there's a problem, and especially for veterans.
What are those biggest obstacles that you see?
Well, they're similar to the obstacles that other homeless people have, you know, affordability. A good number of them have mental health and substance abuse problems.
What are the risks for veterans who slip into homelessness or who have difficulty with the transition from the military to civilian life?
Yeah, I think there's a general feeling that veterans don't like to ask for help. So I think that segment of the homeless population is even more at risk for the kind of spiraling downward effects of homelessness. So pretty dire for veterans.
In September, the state VA closed two of its Veterans Housing and Recovery Program locations, as you know, and the VA cites not enough funding in the state budget. Why is that?
Yeah, we over the last couple of years, it became clear that the program, we operate this program with it's a grant program with the federal government. They pay us $85 a day. Per veteran to run these transition programs. The $85 a day is barely enough to house them, let alone provide the kind of counseling and education to get people back on their feet. And when the governor submitted his budget, he asked for $1.8 million more so that we could keep all three facilities open. Unfortunately, the Joint Finance Committee took that money out. And when the Democrats in the legislature tried to put it back, the Republican majority rejected that effort, all except one. Senator Jacques did vote, pretty unusual move. Senator Jacques voted with the Democrats for an amendment to the budget that would have put that money back in. The Joint Finance Committee did this knowing full well that we would have to close those two facilities. The nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau had prepared a paper that they made available to the Finance Committee before that vote. And it said that if we didn't get, and their estimate was that we needed even more. The nonpartisan Bureau said we needed $3 million to keep that all three facilities open. So when the legislature voted the final vote and didn't put that money back in the budget, we had to make the tough decision to figure out how much money we had, and we could only keep one of the three sites open. So we closed Chippewa Falls in Green Bay and kept open the one down in Union Grove.
So to be clear, if this bill then is signed by Governor Evers, would it reopen the closed facilities?
No, there's a lot of confusion. This bill, if we got the $1.8 million in this that's appropriated in the bill, we could reopen the facility in Green Bay. But this money is going to four programs that are run by nonprofits, all four in the southeast corner of the state. It's a bonus to those organizations to help them make up the difference between the $85 that the federal government gives and the cost of running their programs. So this money will not reopen our facilities. None of it's coming to the VHRP program. This is going to four nonprofits, and we're fully supportive of supporting these nonprofits. They're our partners and they do great work, but they're in Madison, Janesville, and Milwaukee. So it means that none of this money is going to help, no matter what someone might try and tell you, this money is not going to help homeless veterans in the northern and western part of the state.
So what I'm hearing from you is that the federal government and the state government are not providing sufficient funding to meet the needs of these veterans who need help.
Yeah, the federal per diem, the GDP program, does not provide enough to run the program. And the state, the legislature does provide a couple $100,000, but it's not enough to really make these run. These four nonprofits that run these programs, they are able to privately raise funds, you know, solicit money. So they have to backfill that. So they do that, and it takes a lot of work from them, and I think you're going to hear from them. So this $25 will help them and the veterans they serve, but it will not help any other homeless veterans in the state, and it's certainly not going to result in there being these kind of programs available in northern and western Wisconsin.
Joey, thank you so much for the clarity. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Joey Hoey, Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. Now we turn to a Milwaukee-based nonprofit that provides housing and supportive services for veterans in Wisconsin. Greg Fritsch is here, President of the Center for Veterans Issues. Greg, welcome.
For having us on this morning.
Yes, and looking at this bill, providing roughly $1.9 million over the next 2 years to address veterans' transitional housing. Putting it to you, is that enough to meet the needs you see around the state?
Well, it's not enough, but it will go a long way. We're very grateful to have this legislation moving so quickly through the legislature. I think it's going to hit the Senate floor very, very soon. As a result, we run the largest transitional housing and wraparound service program for veterans in the state. And these programs, the transitional housing programs, are difficult because they're 24/7. We provide not only a safe place for them to live, we provide programs, three meals a day, those sorts of things. And those programs cost a lot of money, and we run our program at about $500,000 deficit annually. And so we have to fill that gap by seeking additional funds from donors, hosting additional fundraising events, and find other ways to balance our budget, because costs never stop going up. So this will go a long way to help us provide more beds to veterans. Right now we have 81 men and 5 women in our transitional housing program. They live with us. We feed them 3 times a day. And the $85 we get from the VA, doesn't quite cover all of our costs. So we could receive up to $25 a day through this program, which again would go a long way to cover our gap. So we can continue providing these services.
And Greg, for these 81 men and 5 women, how long will they be in this transitional housing support? What is that transition like for them, where they would move out of this care?
Sure. So we have basically they could stay in the program for up to 24 months.
Okay.
We hope to get them through the program sooner. And our goal, our mission, is to help them create independent living situations again. So we have 64 site scattered apartments. We have another 20 in a transitional housing program. So we try and move them into their own apartments as quickly as we can. We can help them adjust to that financial reality of taking it over themselves through grant programs, through the VA. But the goal is to get them to take over the lease on their own apartment and then continue to support them with aftercare and other subsidies that are available through the VA or HUD or even the Department of Labor.
Greg, your organization is based in Milwaukee. It provides services around the state. As you look around the state, are veterans' housing needs being met in regions outside of southeastern Wisconsin?
Not to the extent that they need to be. Our transitional housing program everything that we do is in southeastern Wisconsin, but we have offices throughout the state. where we don't run transitional housing programs, but we do have wraparound services, and we are able to help vets pay rent, pay half of their rent for up to 6 months, provide them with security deposit assistance, those sorts of things. So that's much more of an independent living situation than what we have in southeastern Wisconsin, where it's transitional.
Do you have waiting lists?
We do have waiting lists, yes. The colder it gets, the longer the list gets. Now, we're not an emergency shelter. We're transitional housing. So we want men and women who will come and stay with us for, you know, 3 to 6 months, if not longer, and then turn them around and get them into an apartment or get them back into their homes, whatever it might be, so that, again, they can begin to live independent lives.
Greg, I wonder, what are the possibilities that you see when you empower these public-private partnerships between the VA and, you know, nonprofit service organizations like yours that are helping vets on the ground level, on the day-to-day?
Well, the public-private model works. It's not perfect, but it works. And the VA and the federal VA and the state VA are very helpful with us and our programs to get these men and women back to where they should be and need to be. As Joey said, there's a lot of substance abuse issues. Just sometimes circumstances conspire. And these men and women who served our country end up homeless. Mm-hmm. They end up on the street. And we have an obligation as a country to take care of them.
Greg, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Greg Fritsch is president of the Center for Veterans Issues. It's a Milwaukee-based nonprofit providing housing and supportive services for veterans throughout the state. We've been discussing veterans' housing needs and a bill that is advancing through the state legislature to help fund a program supporting homeless veterans that was approved by the legislature's Joint Finance Committee this week. We previously spoke with Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs Assistant Deputy Secretary Joey Hoey.
Coming up in Wisconsin Today, Native Americans in Minnesota have been stopped by federal immigration enforcement officials, in some cases detained. In Wisconsin, the president of the Ho-Chunk Nation tells us how tribal members are reacting.
They're not concerned. They're scared. When someone lives like this, they're not going to be living their best life. This is not a safe America the way ICE has presented themselves.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Several Native American citizens have been wrongfully stopped or detained by federal agents in Minnesota as ICE and Border Patrol continue sweeping the area as part of the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration.
For some tribal members, this moment brings up echoes of history back to the late 1960s when the American Indian Movement was founded as a response to police brutality in Minneapolis.
One of the movement's co-founders and spiritual leaders, Eddie Benton Benet, was from the Lukutere tribe in Hayward in northwest Wisconsin. Later, we'll hear from one of his granddaughters about how she's carrying forward his legacy.
But first, Wisconsin tribes find themselves in fear of clashing with law enforcement again. Many tribes are monitoring the situation closely and issuing guidance to their communities, including Lac des Flambeaux, St. Croix, Stockbridge, Muncie, Oneida, and Ho-Chunk.
John Greendeer is president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. I talked to him earlier this week. We've had now multiple reports of Native Americans in Minnesota being questioned, stopped, in some cases detained by immigration authorities there, questioning their citizenship status. What do stories like this bring up for you as the leader of a tribal nation in Wisconsin with a large part of your area in western Wisconsin near that Minnesota border?
Yeah, it's disheartening to hear any reports of this. And, you know, it's actually ironic that people are questioning the citizenship of the Aboriginal and Indigenous people of this area. And then even more ironic that the people that are seeking to find answers to someone's identity are wearing masks and not introducing themselves. And so, you know, it's hard to work with that level of irony.
And what are you hearing from members of your tribe and others in your community about their concerns?
They're not concerned. They're scared. You know, I think it's the invocation of fear into a community to have this reckless policy puts people in a sense that, you know, when someone lives like this, they're not going to be living their best life. This is not a safe America the way ICE has presented themselves. So it is concerning for individuals, for families, for households, for communities. And, you know, we are looking for solutions much larger.
Now, we've got the map, the geography of the United States, but we also have tribal nations, ancestral lands. What does it mean to you to see this kind of border enforcement going on these ancestral lands?
You know, we've been here way before ICE and way before colonization. And, you know, we were in a borderless America where trade and commerce took place, where we had peace and war, and we had, you know, survival and thriving. And so to take a look at now, we are driven by the lines. We are driven by policy initiative that is built on complete ideology and philosophical and fundamental differences of how society should look like. This is hard to manage as a person that someone looks to for comfort and support because, you know, this type of districtism and this type of how they've structured themselves has really, really cascaded across Indian country for the Southwest, Northwest tribes. And I do meet with them regularly across the what we call Turtle Island. And, you know, they're suffering that same way, that they are coming into rural country and disrupting this without any agenda whatsoever.
Do you have advice for members of the Ho-Chunk Nation who may be visiting, going to an area where there's active enforcement, just on a practical level? What can you tell people?
Well, one of the things that we try to do is to do our best to remain calm, that we have triple citizenship, that we are members of the state to whom which we live in, members of the United States federal government, and members of an indigenous nation. We don't have to justify who we are to any further extent than what our legal IDs would provide. So making sure that people have legal identification is one thing. And just being calm, and it, you know, being calm doesn't often and always mean compliant. It doesn't mean surrender your rights. It means to know your rights and be calm but be affirming.
Looking at how this enforcement is playing out, we've heard from the federal government everything from, hey, we're doing targeted enforcement, right? We have a name, we're looking at a person, all the way to we are going door to door. Why is it – obviously, a Native American with that triple citizenship you were talking about shouldn't be on anybody's enforcement radar for immigration. Bluntly, why do you think Native Americans have been targeted and detained in some cases?
Well, I think there's a lot of profiling here. I think we match a lot of the phenotype that of their target market. And, you know, I think a lot of them have just a lack of knowledge of indigenous culture, communities, and what role in history that we've actually played with the United States of America. And for that, you know, I think they have been just adrenalized by the authority that they've been given. And just to capture a brown person, it doesn't matter if they're Native American or from the islands or black, they are really keeping score on this thing. This is what it comes down to.
You're the president of a tribal organization, right, in the United States. Have you been contacted by ICE or the Border Patrol or Homeland Security saying, hey, how can we work together to make sure we don't grab your people?
you know what? I that would be the surprise of my life, that they would actually reach out and try to cooperate. First of all, I'm not going to cooperate with ICE. I know exactly what their agenda is. There is no mitigation in their goal to round up as many people of color, poor people, disabled people. This is not about immigration. This is more about ideology. Second of all, we already have this happening in some sense. You know, we have in the state of Wisconsin, well, actually the United States, a number of agencies and counties who have agreed to jump into a contract, these 287G agreements, where they have extended their own local law enforcement to be arms of ICE, to be arms of Homeland Security. They never consulted us even. Even our own local counties to whom which we resided never contacted their communities before they entered into these agreements. These are going to be problematic later on. So the only outreach that I've seen the Department of Homeland Security do is to basically put a carrot on a stick, provide a lot of money, a lot of funding for tribal communities to expand their detention facilities to harbor people who are undocumented for some time until they are hopefully duly tried. But for that, they have not been reaching out at all to keep some sort of sense of harmony.
I understand that tribal members from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and elsewhere have been joining community patrols in Minneapolis and the surrounding area. People have harkened that back to the American Indian Movement from six decades ago starting. How do you see this moment connecting to a longer history of Native activism?
It's intrinsic for our people to survive. And it doesn't even matter if you're indigenous or not. To what extent would you protect your home, your children, you know, your community? You can take someone who's absolutely rational and civil and contributing to society every single day and you threaten their family. You should expect anything from that individual, from that community, from that family. And this is what I hope happens. I hope people really understand. You know, we've been listening to all this country music for decades and decades about how you're going to protect your little home and what's going to happen if someone shows up. Now it's happening in front of us. I don't see any one of them. As a matter of fact, you know, this is the most ridiculous turn of events that where people who would have been there to protect the rights of citizens, human beings, you know, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, are silent, completely silent. And this is why I say this has nothing to do with immigration, everything to do with people of color and poor people.
And I think we called you up thinking, hey, we'd talk about how this affects Native Americans, and we have. But I'm hearing a lot of solidarity, not just with fellow tribal members and other tribes in Minnesota, for example, but with immigrants themselves.
Yeah, there's no way to do this by ourselves. We live in a world where we have to grasp hands as American citizens, as United States citizens, and we utilize these histories that we have. We've been here before. Most of these people haven't seen this happen before. The Native Americans, the indigenous peoples across the United States and South America have seen this very thing happen before. We know exactly how this ends, and it doesn't end well for the perpetrators who are infringing on the rights of American citizens.
What do you see as a priority now for organizing within the Ho-Chunk, with other tribal organizations and beyond for the future, for whatever comes next when it comes to immigration enforcement?
I think despite all the differences across American Indian leadership, the tribal leadership has to come together to build a strong and salient and succinct demand of what they expect out of the federal government. No more of this shiny, polished treaty and trust responsibility and co-stewardship and all this BS that, you know, we have to sit here and play the game with. We need solid rules for the federal government when engaging with Indian tribes, Indian communities, Indian individuals. And we need to make sure that the government absolutely follows that. I believe any type of assault on indigenous people should be a felony, and people should be exposed and should be held accountable just like they would anywhere else for any other crime.
And finally, are there things you'd like to see from state and local governments here in Wisconsin, possibly in cooperation with tribal governments, as part of the response to what we're seeing from the federal government?
I think, and unfortunately, Minnesota has to be an example, but I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from state and government, local, municipal leadership on how to prepare for the incoming of any ICE agents. You know, they are not welcome where they're coming. They are not welcome in Ho-Chunk country at all. And, you know, I'm not going to make life easy for them to whatever extent I can. But state government as well has to make sure that when they passed that constitution, that was just not a thing that you can set off to the side, that they gave the responsibility to states and tribes to regulate their health, safety, and welfare. And they have been doing that. For better or for worse, the states have built themselves upon that. Now, because of this, you know, omnibus bill that drops $8 billion into ICE, puts 30,000 boots on the ground to, you know, we've had more wars launched against our own country than we have any other country. That we've had the military, we've had the Marines dispatched out to California, the National Guard facing citizens of the United States for simply protecting their rights. And we don't think that there's something wrong with that. The state has to understand that they have a lot of authority. And so the governor, no matter what governor you are, no matter what lever you pull at the polling stations, you have to understand that the protection of the health, safety, and welfare of all of your citizens is the most important thing that you should be thinking about every morning that you wake up.
President Greendeer, thanks again for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That was John Greendeer, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. We're talking about the tribal response to immigration enforcement in Minneapolis. Now we turn to Arias Benton-Binet, a designer and jingle-dress dancer. She's a member of the Lacouture Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and the granddaughter of Eddie Benton-Binet, an Ojibwe activist and co-founder of the American Indian Movement of the 1960s. Recently, she's been sharing videos of her jingle dress on social media for hundreds of thousands of viewers. Arias, thanks for being with us.
Of course, it's a beautiful day.
Well, now, tribes across Wisconsin have issued statements about ICE's presence and activities in Minneapolis, including your tribe, Lakota Ray. What does that mean to you as you're watching things unfold over in Minnesota?
To me personally, well, I think it's really important that as tribal nations and even just as a tribal individual, we are aware of what's going on and speaking out against the violence that we see today.
As we were just talking about, the American Indian Movement got started in the late 1960s, and your grandfather, Eddie Benton-Binet, was one of the people behind that movement. Can you give us a little bit of background on that family history and his involvement?
Of course. The very first American Indian Movement meeting actually started in the Stillwater State Prison. It was in July of 1968. Clyde Belcourt and my grandfather, they happened to be in prison at the same time. And they met by sheer chance. And as Indigenous men being criminalized for protesting and standing up for their rights, you know, they resonated with each other. And so, firstly, it started as a movement to stand up for your tribal sovereignty, your rights. They were speaking out against police brutality at that time, and they realized what was going on with our people in the city. You know, urban natives didn't have centers like we do today, like the American Indian Center in Minneapolis, or programs that helped the well-being of Native people. So they were protesting against that. And it started mostly, firstly, as a spiritual movement. My grandpa was a very spiritual person, and he helped us realize that the basis of the American Indian Movement is strong Anishinaabe Native identity. And so that was his vision, is to be strong in who we are as a people. If we're strong, we can speak out against these things that we see, the injustices and the violence that was going on and is still going on today.
What are your own memories of participating in activism with your grandfather?
I grew up going to protests. I remember protesting here in Hayward, Wisconsin. We were protesting during the Idle No More movement. I remember going to Standing Rock. We were protesting the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I was very young at that time, but that's how I was raised, is to use my voice and for what you believe in. And what we believe in is equality, human rights, all of that.
And does that influence your reaction today to what you see from immigration enforcement going on in Minnesota?
Of course. I mean, what we were protesting with the Dakota Access Pipeline, we were protesting with Idle No More, we were protesting about, you know, ICE out, all of that, they're all interconnected.
I want to give a listen to something you did recently, a video on social media titled Anishinaabe Perspectives on ICE. It features you dancing in your jingle dress to the sound of powwow vocals. Let's take a listen. So we're listening to that video on the radio. Can you paint us a picture of what we see?
Of course. So I am dancing in a white jingle dress. This jingle dress represents the healing of the winter time. And for Ojibwe people, it's a time of healing and self-reflection. You know, you kind of slow down in your movements in your daily life. And so that dress, I had made that dress a while back. And it sort of resonated with the meaning, you know, and what I was sharing when I posted that dress was that the healing comes from like ice cracking. And that's significant now, symbolically, you know, to ice being healing. And we see ice being violent, and to put it simply. And so I wanted to share that, you know, the opposites of, you know, our traditions, and then opposites of what's going on in Western society and in the main society that we see in our communities.
In your videos, you talk about an indigenous native concept of the meaning of relatives. What does that idea mean to you now?
Relatives. So when we say relatives, we talk about all of our relations. We have relations to each other, me and you. We have relationships to our communities and the earth as well. It's not just human to human. It's human to the earth that gives us life and all of that. And so when I say relatives, I mean all living beings.
Arias, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Arias Benton-Benet, a jingle dress dancer from the Lacouture Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, granddaughter of Eddie Benton-Benet, co-founder and spiritual leader of the American Indian Movement. Earlier, we heard from Ho-Chunk President John Greendeer. Been talking about how tribes in Wisconsin are responding to immigration enforcement surges and stops and apprehensions in some cases of Native Americans in neighboring Minnesota.
Coming up, a writing workshop in Madison helps seniors tell their life stories.
Everybody has lived a life that is rich and full. And it just sometimes takes a while to say, okay, that happened to me. Can I write about that?
Inside the class called Writing Your Life, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the saying goes, everyone has a story to tell, but many people never get around to writing about the important moments, ideas, and feelings that made up their lives.
What do you want family and friends to know about your life? What do you think future generations could learn from reading about what life was like for you? How do you write about painful experiences that you went through?
Mark Knepper is a retired English teacher and journalist. He realized that he could help Wisconsinites express themselves through writing, and he created the Writing Your Life workshop for seniors. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me to your program.
We also have two workshop participants. Lori Janis is here, retired from the city of Madison, and Meg Meyer is a retired mathematics educator in UW-Madison School of Education. Lori and Meg, welcome to you both.
Well, thank you for having us.
It's wonderful to be here.
Lori, let's start with you. Why did you want to start writing about your life?
Well, I kind of didn't. but I took a chance and went to my first class there at the Senior Center. And I loved it so much that I just kept coming back.
What made you hesitate about writing your life story?
It's just not something I ever wanted to do, and it felt a little overwhelming to think about 60 years and all the events and all the things that happened and shaped my life, and I just wasn't all that interested in putting all that down on paper, I guess.
So where did you dip in? Where did you begin?
Well, I dipped in with what was going on now, and as the few years that I've been in the class have gone by, I've gone a little deeper and a little farther back and remembered a lot of significant events and so a lot of really insignificant events, but they're all part of me. And they're all part of who I've become.
Such a tapestry, yeah. Meg, I understand that you have a photo of your family that triggered your desire to write about your life. Can you tell us about this photograph and how it inspired you?
It's a typical Christmas time photograph. You can see a Christmas tree in the back of our living room. And it's a photo probably taken in the late 40s. And it's the five of us of my family. And I know I really like the photograph, but I noticed, about 5 years ago that it is really, really fading. It will disappear. And I realized as the last member of that family that the photo is like a metaphor of memories. I'm the last one who has the memories of that family. So I've designated myself as keeper of the memories. And that means that most of the time when I'm writing about family members and things that happened that were important to them. For example, this morning I got off into a reminiscence about my father watching Westerns on television. And I think that will be my next story.
What type of Westerns did he love?
Oh, Gunsmoke, for sure. anything where it was a, you know, good versus evil. I think he probably was born maybe 50 years too soon or too late. He would have been the town sheriff or the gentleman who was eager to join the posse to restore law and order.
It sounds like, Meg, that you write about whatever bubbles up from your past, because a lifetime is a lot of memories to hold inside of oneself. So how do you approach this in a rigid way? Do you kind of go with the flow as to what to write about?
I absolutely go by the flow. Sometimes it's something that happens to me and I think it's noteworthy, but I don't just sit down and write. Sometimes the ideas will percolate over the course of a day or a week before I'll think, oh, this is the approach I want to take. And then I can sit down and come up with a title or a first line. And then the writing becomes much more deliberate, I guess.
Mark, turning to this workshop, this must be really fun for you to encourage this type of writing. How did this workshop develop?
By chance, I would say. I was having a conversation with a good friend and former colleague, and she mentioned that she would speak with her aunt, an elderly aunt, once or twice a month, and they would just trade stories. And she said to me, I wish there was some way for her to formally, record those stories. I took that conversation and just pondered on long walks and thought, what can I do with that? And I had just retired. And the idea came to me to create this workshop. And the title of the workshop came to me instantly. That was the first thing, Writing Your Life. And then I decided to fashion the workshop after some protocols and strategies that I've used with the Greater Madison Writing Project through the University of Wisconsin and the National Writing Project, but then also to incorporate writing instruction to the workshop so that it's not just saying to people, here, go write. I'm actually trying to encourage them by giving them some writing knowledge and strategies.
What prompts do you think help people open up and give them some, scaffolding to start this process?
I use a lot of prompts, and One of the participants in the workshop said to me once, I just hate prompts. It was kind of a funny moment. And then the prompts kept coming and she said, oh, I think I need the prompts. And she found herself oftentimes writing about the prompts that I would share with them. And the prompts are based oftentimes on things that happen in my life. And then I think, can people write about this? Can I craft it into a prompt? And sometimes I look online for prompts that I might use. Some prompts come from reading I'm doing on writing memoir. The idea of the prompts, though, is just to get the engine started. If you think about a cold car in the winter, you need to warm things up. Sometimes people get overwhelmed with the idea of trying to write about their life. So my focus is, instead of writing about this big span of your life, to write about a moment and see if there's a story there. And then if there's a story there, see if there's some meaning you can apply to the story.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Mark Knepper is with us, former newspaper reporter and high school English teacher, developed this workshop called Writing Your Life. And two of the participants, Meg Meyer and Lori Janis, are with us as well. You know, Lori, who is your audience here? Who do you want to read about your life?
Because the class has been so significant, I go to them first. I just find myself writing for them. Certainly for myself first. I share with my husband, who is my best cheerleader. But when I want to dig a little deeper and get a little better quality of writing, I go to the class.
You feel like you get that honest feedback and support.
Oh, completely. Yes. The critiques are well thought of, well thought out, and kind, but a good spur to get me to do better. So I really appreciate that.
Meg, do you think about people reading the stories that you're writing about your past and what they might feel about them?
Sometimes I do, but often I don't think about who's going to read them while I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
Although of late, I have been embracing the idea of story as gift. In this way, it happened at Christmas time that I wrote about receiving Christmas cards over the past. And I was pretty happy with the story as it evolved. And I thought, I should send this to, and I thought of a dear friend. And I sent him a copy, and he was mentioned in my story. So my story became a gift to him. I have given copies of my stories to my two adult children. By the way, I'm not sure that they read them. But they have them. And at some point, if they haven't already read them, they will. But I really like the idea of story as gift. And now as I think about perhaps this story about my father and watching Westerns, I will send it to his granddaughters. That might be a gift to them.
Oh, I think that's a beautiful, beautiful idea. Mark, I would imagine that some of your participants have trouble writing about painful chapters in their lives. What can be gained by reflecting on those hard times?
That is a really good question, and that is oftentimes a struggle for people. They really are hesitant to go into those memories of past events that were hard. And if they do, take a look at it, think about it, and reflect on not just the moment, but what it meant for them, might lead them to a better understanding of themselves or of that time period in their lives. But it can be really hard. And I always stress the idea that you don't ever have to write about something that you don't want to. If it's too hard to write about it, put it aside. You might be able to go back to it later, you might never go back to that really difficult thing to write about. But if you do, there might be some rewards. There also might be some difficulty, because as you start really digging into your memory, things come up that maybe you have buried, and then you have to deal with those things.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm thinking back to the participant who poo-pooed prompts at first, and I'm wondering, you know, what would you say to someone who thinks, you know, I don't have interesting events to write about. I don't see my life as something where I can write some really meaningful stories.
There are people who say that, and I suggest to them then think about your life in terms of segments or moments or time periods and see what comes up. Everybody has lived a life that is rich and full. The experiences inform how we lived our life then and how we live our life now. And it just sometimes takes a while to say, okay, that happened to me. Can I write about that?
Lori, do you think of your life differently now after writing about your past?
I think that I have looked at my life a little differently, thanks to the class and to writing about it. I think initially it was, as Mark would say, I was the hero of my own story. And the antagonists, I think I've learned to look at the antagonists a little differently, look at things from their viewpoint, and appreciate kind of a deeper understanding of some of what I've been through and what has happened. And the good times maybe are a little better, and the bad times maybe are a little better too for having taken the class and writing about them and sharing those experiences.
Meg, what comes up for you?
Within the class time, there's always some time for, we call it we can read our stories aloud.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that reading and listening to somebody reading aloud is really significant. First of all, as the writer, I find that when I am stumbling over my written words, it probably means that I need to work on that passage a little bit more. But hearing someone speak their story is really powerful. And when I can elicit a giggle or a smile at an appropriate time, I think, I've hit the mark. Hit the mark there.
Yeah.
And it's encouraging for me to keep going. I just find great satisfaction in that.
Those are participants of the workshop Writing Your Life, Lori Janis and Meg Meyer, and instructor Mark Knepper, a retired journalist and English teacher who created this writing class through the Greater Madison Writing Project.
We just learned about a workshop that helps you write your life story, and we heard from Christy, who sent a message about being involved with a group kind of like that for several years.
Christy says, we meet monthly and share our writing if it feels safe to do so. Each month, we tackle a different topic. Sometimes people write about a specific childhood memory, event, or experience that relates to a given writing prompt, but always we're encouraged to write what's on your heart and what you want to put down in black and white to be shared with those you love.
And Christy says there's a sense of community in that writing group. Christy, thanks for sharing. You can add your experience about putting your life story into words. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Rochelle Wilson, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.